A state, first and foremost, exists subjectively in the minds of a people, a national grouping, who believe that they're connected to each other, who believe that they have a certain destiny, and believe that they want to be in the same place building and maintaining that state.
Dr. Palisar, in this next lecture, we're going to meet some of the other important figures in the Zionist movement. After publishing this tremendous book, Herzl makes a decision about the next big thing he has to do. What is that?
So the next big thing he determines to do is a world congress of all of the Zionists, all the people who support this Jewish state. And the decision on the one hand makes perfect sense because he wrote a book. And in the book, it says, you need a society of Jews, and that society of Jews brings together people from around the world and determines, is there interest in moving? Where do these people want to move to? And then once it's established a consensus and has built the beginnings of an institution, it represents the Jews in negotiations. So this is the logical next step if you see the Jewish state as a blueprint. But if you step back for a moment and consider what were the options that Herzl had, it's not at all obvious that this is the right option. First of all, he had the option of letting others take over. And both in his writing and in speaking to people, he had indicated, I'm going to do one thing, I'm going to put the book out there, I'm going to raise the question, I'm going to point the way, and I'm going to let other people take over. So he could have done that. I mean, he couldn't really have done that because he was obsessed. He had to solve the Jewish problem. He couldn't bear the dishonor and the suffering of the Jews. So he had to see this through to the end. And he had his own confidence, and he believed that although he had his flaws, of which he was aware, nonetheless, he thought there were certain aspects of this that only he got. And when he would start moving into some new area and think others surely will be able to figure this out and do the right thing, he would say, no, they're doing it all wrong. So he didn't really have the option of leaving it alone, but in theory he did. He also had the option of deepening the ideas spade work that he was doing because he had put out this book, but it was a relatively short book. It was being translated into more than half a dozen languages, and in many cases he knew those languages well enough to be supervising or knew people who knew them and could be involved in that. He got numerous invitations to speak, especially from student groups, but also from others. And he could have gotten the word out that way, and he could have written retorts to his critics. There was a lot he could have done. And that was what he was naturally best suited to do. That was closest to his comfort zone because ultimately he was a writer. He had been a speaker and he was getting those abilities back as well. And yet he couldn't do that because he wanted to move quickly and the writing was too slow a way of getting there. He wanted to move quickly because he felt that this was the moment. He wanted to move quickly because he didn't know how long he was going to live. He knew he had health issues. He knew he had heart troubles. And he was looking for not the easiest way to solve this problem, but the shortest way to solve this problem. So just the getting the ideas out there wasn't enough. He also had the diplomacy option. He had been to Istanbul, Constantinople for a couple of weeks. He was negotiating with the secretary of the foreign ministry within the Ottoman Empire. He was negotiating with the Sultan's secretary. He was received by the Grand Vizier, which is to say effectively the prime minister of the Ottoman Empire. So he had some successes diplomatically. So he also had that as a route, and he could just continue with that and not expose himself to the possible opposition to a Congress or the possible opposition at a Congress. But I think he understood that diplomatically he was going to be limited because ultimately the question, who are you and who do you represent and why should we take you seriously and what can you promise us and what can we expect as a result of speaking to you? He didn't have a good answer to that. All he could say is, I'm a journalist from a leading newspaper and I hold the leading position there and lots of Jewish people come to me and say that they're supportive. He would put it much more eloquently than that. But what they would hear is what I just said. He wanted to come to these same world leaders as the representative of the Jewish people. And for that he needed a Congress.
So who are some of the people that he invited?
So let's start with the categories. He started by inviting a lot of people from Western Europe And more or less, they were not so interested in coming to it. And part of what happened is he recognized that in order to get the horses to this, in order to have enough people, he would have to open up much more to Russian Jewry, including the predecessor organization, Chibat Zion, sometimes called Chovavei Zion, the Lovers of Zion, who had formed in 1881. So there were a very significant number of people coming from Eastern Europe. He was inviting Jews and non-Jews alike, and in fact it was attended by Jews and non-Jews alike. He was inviting very famous people, most of whom didn't choose to come. And in the end, he actually refers to the fact that he is the leader of an army of schnorrers, right? An army of beggars. That's referring not just to the conference, but it's referring to the people who were surrounding him. He at times had great respect for those who signed up with him, and at times he felt that he had not been fully blessed in terms of the individuals who rallied around his flag. The most famous person who came to the conference was Max Nordau. He was one of Herzl's earliest converts to Zionism, and he had a cachet that nobody else there had. He was truly internationally famous. Herzl put him in a very prominent position within the conference, and Nordau gave what is widely regarded as the great oration of the First Zionist Congress. So Nordau was there, Menachem Ussishkin was there, a leading figure in the Russian Zionist world. Chaim Weizmann was there, later went on to very prominent positions. There was an observer who became Herzl's fiercest critic, Ahad Ha'am, the great Jewish writer and gadfly, and sometime activist who believed that what was needed was a cultural center in Israel rather than a political center in Israel. And there were many, many, many people who most of us, perhaps with good reason, haven't heard of. This was not a conference of very famous people. It was a conference of people, some of whom were known, many of whom became known, and many of whom were simply there in this moment helping to fill the ranks. Part of Herzl's genius was taking this group of people that, if you really looked at the resumes on paper and asked, does this broadly reflect the Jewish world? And more specifically, does it reflect the leadership of the Jewish world? You'd have to say, no, this is not the who's who of world Jewry. And yet, through the way he inspired them and through the way he almost stage managed the entire conference, Herzl created the impression that this really was the sovereign Jewish people scattered around the earth, having come together in this great moment to redeclare their allegiance to the dream of a Jewish state. That inspiration, that ability to imagine something that wasn't and bring it into reality, and by bringing it into reality, bring it closer to becoming a true reality, that was a part of Herzl's genius, and that was Herzl the journalist, but it was Herzl the playwright and Herzl the man of ideas. It was Herzl as the Jew of the spirit.
Can you just share with us some of the highlights from the agenda of the conference? What did they debate and discuss?
So they discussed anti-Semitism, and there were reports from delegations around the world explaining what the Jewish life is like, and some major addresses, I noted in particular Max Nordau's, about Jewish conditions. I think Herzl wanted everybody there to understand you're not alone. If things are bad with you, you're not at all alone, and you should recognize that's the pattern. That accomplished a number of things. It gave people a sense of commonality. It also gave people a sense that the grass is not so much greener on the other side of the fence. So anti-Semitism was a significant aspect. There was also some discussion of what was happening in the settlements in Palestine. This might not have been Herzl's first choice, but because the conference de facto represented a coalition with the Chibat Zion movement, which was principally involved in settlements in the land of Israel, there was some discussion of those settlements and of the need to continue supporting them. There was a moment where it was asked that they should vote their thanks for the patron of these settlements, Edmund de Rothschild. And Herzl was able successfully to forestall such a thing because he didn't think it was appropriate to be giving this kind of a central role to a man backing what he saw as infiltration into the land of Israel, which was ultimately, in his view, going to backfire. And yet, if this was put to a vote, how could the participants be anything other than grateful to the tremendous, tremendous investment by Baron Rothschild? So they would be stuck in a dilemma. They couldn't vote yes and they couldn't vote no. So that he was able to deftly turn aside. The most important issues, though, were what would go in the platform, the Basel platform that was ultimately adopted. And here, I think the key question had to do with the language. On the one hand, there were people there who wanted to put it right out there. We are interested in creating a Jewish national state in the land of Israel, if at all possible, and somewhere else if not. But that could be provocative. There was always concern of what would the Sultan, the leader of the Ottoman Empire, think about what was being said. What would the secret police of the Tsar think about what was being said? And so they couldn't be too forthright. On the other hand, if this was too much in the realm of obfuscation, too much clouded, then it wouldn't really inspire people and it wouldn't give Herzl the mandate that he needed in order to negotiate. So there was very careful compromising of the language so that ultimately what came out is that this is the pursuit of a national homeland and it needs to be publicly recognized, but it didn't speak in very clear terms of a Jewish state under international law. At the end of our last lecture, we left Theodor Herzl having cast the die, having published their Judenstaat, the Jewish state, in February of 1896. And as we saw, the reactions were mixed. In the West, they were negative, with a tendency towards disparaging, making fun of him, talking about him and his ideas as being crazy, and so on. In the East, the picture was both more hopeful and more nuanced. On the one hand, there was great enthusiasm among the 5 million plus Jews in the Russian Pale of Settlement, a sense that maybe this was the moment, maybe they could not only leave, but go to a place that was genuinely better and be a part of the national history they cared about so much. And yet at the same time, at least within certain Orthodox circles, there was a concern that this is not our decision to make. This man, this Dr. Theodor Herzl, he's not God. He's not God's agent, the Messiah, and it's not up to him to tell us that this is the time to return to the Promised Land. But at least on the eastern side, there was a promise of troops, of men and women who might join this movement, who might be a part of it, perhaps who might even be willing to be the pioneers to move to Israel. And whatever one wants to say about the success or the failure of the Jewish state, you can say the following. It was successful enough to create a dilemma. If it had come out stillborn, if there hadn't been a David Wolfson and a Reverend Hechler coming to Herzl and volunteering their services, if there hadn't been these invitations from student groups, if there hadn't been a sense, at least among some people, that something significant was happening, then presumably Herzl would have just said, okay, I failed. I thought it was a political tract. It turns out that I should have written a novel because this work was itself a fantasy, and we wouldn't be here telling this story. But it was successful enough to create a dilemma for once your first move has worked and you might be en route to building a movement, what do you do next? How do you capitalize on it? And how do you keep marching as steadily and as quickly as you can towards the Promised Land? What we're going to do in this lecture is to begin by speaking about the developments shortly after the publication of the Jewish state that played a role in shaping the environment in which Herzl and his colleagues had to make the decision as to what's next. Against that background, we're then going to consider the strategic dilemma that Herzl faced, and we're going to understand together why it is that he made the decision that he made. Having done those things, understood the strategic environment and the decision that Herzl, as a budding leader, made, we're then going to talk about three aspects of the course of action that followed. Because, of course, we know he opted to launch a Zionist Congress. And so we're going to look at the difficulties in setting up that Congress, as well as the preparations that helped get around those difficulties. Then we're going to talk about the conference itself. What happened there, what decisions were made, what atmosphere was created, what happened during those three fateful days. And finally, we're going to talk about what were the consequences of this Congress. And we're going to talk about it again in terms of the challenges that Herzl faced and how it helped him to overcome those challenges, helped him and, of course, helped the growing movement around him. And we'll conclude with a few observations about Herzl and institution building and what it meant ultimately for the Zionist movement. So let's begin with the developments after the Jewish state came out. And we discussed a number of them in the previous lecture with a focus on reactions. But I want to look at it now in terms of developments that helped Herzl with this first goal of getting the word out, developing the ideas, persuading people, the intellectual challenge of establishing a Jewish state, because there were a number of very promising developments. For starters, as noted, there were translations begun literally within weeks of the publication of the German edition, translations into English, Russian, Yiddish, Hebrew, Spanish, French, Romanian. Also, Herzl received many, many invitations from student groups to come and address them, as well as from other Jewish groups, some small number of Chibat Zion groups, the veterans of Zionist activity over the previous decade and a half. And finally, he had many, many meetings set up often at the initiative of other people who themselves had either been Zionist activists or were considering this course of action and wanted to talk to Herzl in order to speak about how they might help him, in some cases how he might help them, right? People who were in debt and wanted to be paid to help with the movement, all kinds of people, but many, many hours spent in talking to individuals who might potentially play a role in getting the word out. So Herzl clearly had an opportunity, if he wanted to take it, to deepen each of those activities. Every translation was something he could work on. He could be pounding the pavement, as it were, to try to get more reviews for the book, more people to write about it, lobbying the publisher, more copies, more editions, and the like. So he could have, and of course, the number of speeches he could have given is probably close to infinite. The number of groups who would want to hear him, given the travel time between each place, he could spend his time doing that. So there were developments that made it both a work that reached a larger number of people and created an opportunity for him to invest further time in those efforts. There were also some pretty exciting developments on the diplomatic front. The work came out, the book came out February of 1896. By April, a mere 2 months later, Herzl was already visiting the capital of the Grand Duchy of Baden, where he met, thanks to the eccentric but apparently effective Reverend Heckler, with Grand Duke Friedrich I, who, in addition to being a Grand Duke, no small matter in the German Empire of that time, was also the uncle of Kaiser Wilhelm and somebody who was biblically deeply connected and took an immediate liking to Herzl and especially to Herzl's idea and said quite openly, "I want to take this idea and you to the Kaiser. I would like to make the Kaiser the person who extends the protectorate so that there really can be a beginning of a Jewish national homeland in Israel, in Palestine, in your ancestral homeland." A month later, May 15th, Herzl held his first meeting with the Papal Nuncio in Vienna. It was not a smashing success. It turned out that there were still some theological and political issues dividing the Catholic Church and the Jewish people. But the fact that he got that audience and that it could potentially be followed by more showed that the diplomatic path had some promise. Perhaps most important, again, just one more month after that, during the last 2 weeks of June, from the 15th to 30th, Herzl had his first visit to Constantinople, along with the rather colorful agent whom he hired, Philip Michael Nevlinsky, who had a background as a diplomat and as a spy and as a double agent and as a whole host of things for which the word adventurer pales as a description. And together they went to Constantinople, to Istanbul, the capital of the Ottoman Empire, and they began navigating the long and complicated and arduous process of Byzantine diplomacy. And although Herzl didn't get to the very top, he didn't manage to meet with the Sultan on this trip, he did meet with the secretary of the Ottoman Foreign Ministry, he met with the secretary of the Sultan, and at the very end of his visit, he met with the Grand Vizier, who was effectively the prime minister in that government. Prime minister under the president, by which I mean the Sultan, but nonetheless, somebody in a very significant position. And he felt that he was making progress both in getting his case across, understanding the labyrinth of Ottoman diplomacy, and perhaps even starting to make friends, or if not friends, at least acquaintances who might be helpful to him. And so on the diplomatic front, there were also developments that both taught Herzl and opened up opportunities for him. And in parallel, on a third front, he was also making the beginnings of progress, and that was with the idea of a conference. Right? The idea of a Zionist Congress, a world congress, had always been out there. It was kind of an obvious way to get the Society of Jews started. It also had been the method that was used by Chibat Zion. A few years after its founding, they held their first conference in Katowice. And it's just expected, if you're trying to represent all of world Jewry, or at least a substantial portion of world Jewry, then you need to bring them together at some point in one room, in one hall, in one place, and have a discussion and reach conclusions. And so, not surprisingly, within a few weeks of the publication of The Jewish State, the leader of Sophia's Jewish community, somebody who had studied in Vienna and had been among the founders of Kadima, which was a very important student Jewish group there, wrote to Herzl and congratulated him on his, quote, political essay. And then he told Herzl that he was waiting in suspense for Herzl to convene a conference of, quote, all the Zionists from all lands in order to organize the apparatus of liberation. Right? He had read the book and he knew what was supposed to happen next. There was supposed to be a society of Jews and we were supposed to come together and we were supposed to form a Jewish company and negotiate with the nations of the world, and he was ready for it to happen. Before that month of March was out, an assembly of Jewish students and young people in Lemberg, the capital of Galicia, an area that was kind of ripe for Herzl's message, declared allegiance to the principles laid out in Herzl's The Jewish State and called on Herzl to head an organization to carry out the program. Right? There wasn't a Zionist organization at this point. There was a guy in Vienna named Theodor Herzl who wrote a book that was published in 3,000 copies and sent out to various people around the world, but there was no organization to speak of other than Chibat Zion, which had not proven to be terribly effective. So let's now take a step back and consider what the arguments were for and against each of the strategic courses that Herzl could follow as a second big, bold step after publishing The Jewish State. First option, which we have to put on the table, is step aside and let others do the work. There are a number of hints and statements in Herzl's writings, as well as in conversations he had with people, in which he indicated, my role is to raise the question, to put the idea out there, and then the Jewish people as a whole will have to make their determination. Is this something you will? Is this something you want? Is this something you're willing to put your heart and soul into? Because if it is, then they could go out, even without Herzl's help, and make it a reality. And if they didn't want it, then that was up to them. He at least had done his duty, had raised the issue, put it on the table, and now, with good, clean conscience, he could step back and lead the life that he liked, the life of the writer, the life of a figure of culture, the life of a man with heart difficulties who perhaps wanted to live longer and not face too much stress. Right? There were plenty of good reasons for him to sit this out. But he couldn't do it. Right? Yes, it's an option I'm putting on the table. He had put it on the table. It was in writing. It was spoken about, but he couldn't do it for two simple reasons. The first one was he was a proud Jew who couldn't stand what had been done to his people. He couldn't stand the degradation. He couldn't stand the anti-Semitism. He couldn't stand the continuation of what he called the Jewish question. And he had to make sure that something was done about it. And now, having discovered what he saw as the truth, the one truth that we had to form our own nation in our own place under our own responsibility, he couldn't just leave it out there unless he was convinced that others could do it. And that's the second point. Herzl was a pretty confident person. He was a fairly critical person. And even in those circumstances in which he would hand things over to others to do, almost always he would discover they just didn't quite get it right. They didn't get the bank right. They didn't get the arrangements for where the Congress should be the right way. They didn't get the wording the right way. They didn't give the speech they should have. They didn't wear the right suit. They did a lot of things. And he always had the sense, often at least had the sense, he knew how to do this. He had thought about it. He had learned about the world. He'd learned about the world as it is as a journalist and the world as it could be as a writer of plays. And so Herzl, in the end, couldn't sit it out because he wanted it to succeed and he really believed that he was central to its success. So that left him with three reasonable options for what he should do as his prime focus going forward. One of those options was continue the ideas spade work. Right? There was plenty of interest in it. He could have given more speeches. There were plenty of people writing against him. He knew how to write a good refutation. He knew how to write powerfully, persuasively, good arguments. He could have continued with the ideas spade work and probably moved himself and his movement in a good direction in establishing a Jewish state. But there was a downside, and the downside was this is a slow method. You get another convert and another convert and another few hundred converts, but ultimately, you're not building a movement, and ultimately, you're not securing a land with international backing for it. And Herzl probably felt that it was just too slow a method, given that his own clock was ticking, but especially the world's clock was ticking. He was seeing Jews suffering more and more, and he didn't know how much worse it would get and how quickly. And I think there was another reason why he didn't want to just continue with the spade work. Once he had put the idea out there and people were talking about it and people were asking him, will you lead the movement and what's going to happen? He was creating an opportunity for somebody. And if he didn't act on that opportunity by doing something decisive beyond writing and beyond speaking, then there was no telling who might use this opportunity to steer this ship in the wrong direction. He watched politics in France very closely, in Paris for 4 years. And I think he understood that in politics, you have to move. You have to move quickly. When an opportunity is created, he who hesitates is lost. And he didn't want to be he who hesitates. So I think he ruled out that area as his principal area. Second viable option, was to engage in diplomacy. He had just gotten started, and he was already in meetings with senior-level people at the two most significant powers. Right, the two most significant powers as the world looked in 1896 were the Ottomans, because they controlled the land of Israel, Palestine, and the Germans, because they were the closest ally of the Ottomans and therefore had the greatest chance of either creating a German protectorate for the Jews or persuading the Ottomans to create such a protectorate under the Sultan there. So he was making progress, and perhaps if he focused just on that, enough writing, enough meeting with all sorts of people who come to Vienna, just travel, make friends in the right capitals, and move it forward, maybe that could be the answer. But it also had a drawback. And the drawback was he probably sensed he was hitting something of a limit. Because in the end, he was one guy, 35 years old, from Vienna, and he couldn't credibly say that he was speaking for the Jewish people. It wasn't as if he could show them a whole pack of very positive reviews or petitions from hundreds of thousands of Jews around the world supporting him. He knew that his support was tenuous, and he knew that his interlocutors understood that his support was tenuous because they read the same newspapers that he read. So I think he felt that there were diminishing returns to diplomacy in that moment. And that left the choice of a conference. A conference, a congress, something that would actually build this society of Jews that he had written about in the Jewish state. And there were a number of advantages to this method. One, it gets the message out more effectively, because now you're bringing people together and those people can be your advocates. Now, the idea looks much more real, it looks much more feasible. So I think the Congress probably appealed for that reason. It could also, if it went well, create a movement that would work internationally and that would be durable and therefore able to lead this struggle for the decades that it would take. It would make Herzl a more serious player internationally, and it would also make the Society of Jews or the Jewish collective or the Jewish people look like the kinds of folks one should sit down with at a negotiating table in order to talk about the future of the world and the future of the Jews and the connection between those things. So in the end, there were compelling reasons to choose this, but there were also some serious drawbacks. And his advisors warned them about those drawbacks. When you're at a conference, when you're at a Congress, you don't know what's going to happen. You can't fully control who ends up showing up. You might not even be able to control who gets invited. And once people are there, all kinds of things happen that you couldn't predict and that you couldn't control. Not only that, what if you called a Congress and nobody came? Right? When Chibat Zion held its first Congress, in its first international conference in Katowice, 30 people showed up. 3 minyanim, right? This is not a very effective show of force. What if he couldn't get enough people there? Well, what if the people he got there were obviously extras, fillers, people of no great name, no great repute, and didn't really represent others, right? It was a betting the farm kind of a move, because if it hadn't succeeded, then what it would have showed everybody is this movement doesn't have legs, and this leader doesn't have followers. But Herzl, as he often did, was willing to bet the farm, was willing to take the big, bold risk, a characteristic that you'll observe often when you see great leaders. So onward and upwards, he made a decision to go ahead with the Congress, together, obviously, with his colleagues. 4 big challenges faced them. Actually, each challenge and its solution bringing on the next challenge. So the first one was getting enough serious people. 30 would not be enough. Doubling Chibat Zion's 30 would not be enough. There needed to be hundreds of people. If you couldn't describe this as an event with hundreds of people, it wouldn't do what Herzl needed it to do. And it became clear fairly early on in the game that the response of Western Jews, who in some sense had been Herzl's target, certainly his peer group, their response was lukewarm. And the only way to solve that was by shifting the focus onto Russian Jews, which meant this conference was going to stand or fall on the ability to attract to it Russian Jews and Russian Jews who were credible. That immediately brought about challenge number 2, not angering the Russian authorities, because Russian Jews were not going to travel to a Congress if they weren't going to be allowed back in, or if they'd be allowed back in only to be suspected and arrested. And the Russian authorities were suspicious in general, suspicious of Jews in particular, and suspicious of this potentially seditious nationalist movement that could lead Jews in all sorts of directions that would cause them to be opposed to the Tsarist regime. And so, just by way of one example, and we'll see more, for what was done not to anger the Russians, the original place that Herzl very much wanted the Congress to take place in was Zurich. But there's a problem. Zurich was known by everybody as the haven for radical Russian revolutionaries. And holding it in Zurich meant essentially raising the worst fears of the Tsar's secret police. So Zurich was out. That led to challenge number 3, which is, okay, not in Zurich, where is it going to be? It has to be somewhere centrally located. It's not going to be in Russian territory that the Russian authorities would not be interested in. It has to be a place that's reasonably supportive. You can't have a local community that's dead set against what's happening. Negotiations were held, seemingly successfully, to hold the Congress in Berlin. But within a relatively short period, after Herzl, by the way, had already started communicating with people, inviting them, come to the Congress, it's going to be in Berlin, 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 the local Jewish community rose up and said, not here. The same opposition that we discussed earlier on, that intellectual opposition, the people who have a project of Jewish emancipation and therefore of Jews fitting in and not being overly nationalist and separatist, those people in Berlin felt that this Congress was going to paint them in an overly nationalist light, overly separatist, and was going to set back not only their dreams within Germany, but their own reputation as a community. So the Berlin community let it be known that they did not want this, and Herzl, I think, wisely chose not to provoke a fight on this. And ultimately, the Congress was held, as we all know, in Basel, but not because it was the first choice. It was the third choice, but it helped solve the challenges as they came up. Fourth challenge. You're holding this event in Basel. You need Russian Jews. You need to get a lot of people out there. Well, you have a problem, because the organization that has the greatest access to the very people you need, Chovevei Tzion, is deeply concerned, not only on a personal institutional level that perhaps they're being usurped, but also on an ideological level. They stand for settlement, moving as many Jews as they can, not a large number, but as many as they can, to settle different parts of the land of Israel, to build up new communities. And along comes Theodor Herzl and says, I don't like infiltration, because infiltration ultimately leads to bans on immigration. It's a dead end. It's been a dead end wherever Jews have used it because of human nature, and human nature is not changing. And so Chovevei Tzion weren't wild about Herzl's views, and he wasn't wild about theirs, but they kind of looked at one another and recognized that if they weren't allies with each other, neither one of them was likely to succeed. And so a very tenuous alliance was established en route to the Congress. And as we speak briefly about the steps to actually bring the Congress about, you'll see these various compromises, how they express themselves. So for starters, the moment in which the final decision was made and the concrete steps were taken was March of 1897, and it took place in the Chovevei Tzion offices in Vienna, not by accident, right? On their home turf, showing, we care about you, we want you, and we need you. And the participants, in addition to Herzl and his associates from Vienna, had included representatives from Berlin, Breslau, Katowice, Tarnow. There was an organizing committee elected to make preparations for an all-Zionist Congress. So this was the alliance's first step out. Herzl, by the way, was a smart person, and he knew that he would need to have his own publicity and have at least an organ of publicity that he could control. So in the lead up to the Congress, he, with funding from his family, from his parents, founded Die Welt, which was an explicitly Zionist publication, and Herzl had control of it. Right? We spoke about the various advantages he brought to the table. Well, not only could he write prodigiously, prolifically, but he could also fund when needed, and this was one of those moments when strategic funding was needed. Now, the Congress was set for the first 3 days of Elul, which itself is symbolic, right? Elul is the month in the Jewish calendar where tshuva, repentance, begins before the high holidays. And the idea that as this month is ushered in and we're blowing the shofar every morning in traditional synagogues, in order to rouse us to repentance, to a return, well, this is the moment to return nationally as well. So it was announced as being the first 3 days. And the announcement itself is worth careful attention. And as I've been doing in the other lectures, I want to focus as much as we can on the actual words used by Herzl, because they have a significance. And I think they tell the story better than anything else. So this is the announcement. And as I go through it, I'm going to explain a few of the compromises and a few of the principles that stand behind this. At this conference, our brethren from all over the world will tell us about their circumstances and developments. There it will become clear what the Zionist movement demands from its supporters. There our activity, which has been splintered and divided, will be united. There we shall witness an ingathering of the exiles, which will unite all forces for one great and tremendous effort. Right? This is letting everybody know we're all in this together. This is not just Theodor Herzl. This is not just Chovevei Tzion. This is us together and anyone else who can come in. This is the moment for everybody to stand up and be counted, not a moment for divisiveness. The Congress aims at an immediate and possible end. Any other reports about it are empty air. All activities of the Congress will be totally public. Its debates and decisions will not contravene the laws of any country or our civic duties. We would like especially to guarantee that all acts of the meeting will be acceptable to Chovevei Tzion in Russia and to that country's supreme government. No subtlety here, right? Letting it be clear, Chovevei Tzion's on board. They de facto have a veto over at least key elements, and we have the secret police very much in mind, and we're going to make sure that those of you who want to come from Russia can not only come to the Congress, but can go home afterwards safely. Friends and enemies alike await the Congress, and we have therefore to prove to all that our wishes are clear and our capacity great. If the Congress does not fulfill its goals, our movement will suffer a setback that will last for a long time. It all depends on massive participation of our brethren from Russia, where most of our people reside. We hope that you will recognize your duty and come to our convention. At the meeting, it will be possible to speak in Hebrew. In Basel, there is a kosher hotel. No subtlety here. We need Russians. If this movement doesn't make it, it's because you decided not to make this movement at the most critical moment. And by the way, you're a good Zionist, you want to speak Hebrew, you can do that. You want to avoid the shrimp and the pork, you want kosher food, there's a kosher hotel in Basel. So that invitation itself, I think, encapsulates what the challenges had been and how they were being overcome. Now, that brings us to the Congress itself. It's in Basel. There are about 200 participants, of whom perhaps 70 can legitimately be said to represent actual Zionist organizations. The others are all kinds of people whom Herzl and others invited who were interested and supportive, but couldn't be said to represent hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands. There were, in addition, many spectators and many members of the press, and all of that combined to give it a sense that it really might be a big and significant gathering, if not a full National Assembly. Herzl stage managed this using his judgment and the senses he had developed as a writer of plays. So he got to Basel, and the ground team that was organizing this showed him that they had rented a beer hall for the convention to take place, and he said, "No, we are not founding the Jewish state or any state in a beer hall." And they went out and they got the municipal concert hall, which was much more suitable for this event. There were signs. David Wolfson, one of Herzl's most significant converts, the one who stayed up much of the night reading Herzl's work and then came and essentially presented himself for duty, he created a flag different from Herzl's flag, a flag, in fact, much like the current flag of Israel with the two blue trelet stripes from the talit, the traditional Jewish prayer shawl, and the Star of David in the middle. And everyone was expected to be in formal wear. And there's a famous story made famous in Herzl's diary and by the many biographers who have cited it, that on day one, as the conference was about to begin, Max Nordau, by far the most famous person there, and Herzl's close friend and confidant, showed up not wearing a tuxedo. And Herzl went to him shortly before the proceedings and begged him, "Today, the Zionist Congress is nothing. In the future, it will be everything. but we have to create it. We have to make it that way. We have to persuade people that this is really a great thing happening. You have to go back and put on a tuxedo. And Max Nordau, who was a stubborn individual and had his own taste in all kinds of things, turned around, went back to his hotel room, and showed up in a tuxedo because he knew that that was part of his contribution, was the feeling in the place. Herzl gave the opening speech, and only really one memorable line from it, early on, as was his wont, to make the case very clearly. He said, "We want to lay the foundation stone for the home that is destined to be the haven for the Jewish people." Again, subtleties aside, he wanted to make it clear, we are here with a purpose. This is not a gripe session. This is not just a discussion with a whole range of possibilities. Maybe we'll decide that that emancipation is the right tactic. Maybe we'll decide that the issue needs further study. No. We want to lay the foundation stone for the home that is destined to be the haven for the Jewish people. Now, the conference was 3 days long. And as is the way of conferences, there were more interesting segments, let's say Max Nordau's rousing speech, and there were less interesting segments, let's say the reports country by country of the state of the Jews, which in large part were reports about anti-Semitism, persecution, discrimination, poverty, and the like. But there were two sets of results worth keeping our eye on. The first one was seemingly procedural, but of enormous significance. It was decided at this Congress that there would be an annual Zionist Congress. This is not a one-time event of a founding constituent assembly. Rather, we, the Jewish people, are going to take responsibility through these congresses held each year. Each year we hope they'll grow, bring in more people representing larger numbers. But the idea is there's continuity. But since we know that a lot of things need to happen in between these congresses, what we're going to do is we're going to establish a greater actions committee and a smaller actions committee, and they're actually going to get work done in between, in diplomacy and institution building and all of the things you need to create a movement. Not surprisingly, Herzl was not only the chair of the Congress, but he also became the elected head of the movement and responsible for the day-to-day operations. So forget the idea of his stepping aside. He stepped forward even further into these responsibilities. So that was one consequence. The second consequence, which we're going to look at in just a little bit of detail, is the what's called the Basel program, which is the program that was adopted at the end of the Congress. Has just a few planks, but each one of them tells us something about the principles of the Zionist movement and something about the compromises that went into it. So it begins. Zionism seeks to establish a home for the Jewish people in Palestine, secured under public law. Very important because it's a goal, very important because it's naming a particular place. Palestine is not Argentina. Very important because it's actually meant to be a home for this people, not just Jewish immigration, a few more farms, a few more communities. But note what isn't in it. It does not say Jewish state. There was concern about alienating the Sultan. It does not say secured under international public law or international public guarantees. That was also thought to be diplomatically problematic. And the Congress had probably its sharpest disputes about this language, where you had maximalists who wanted to say right out there, we want a Jewish state in Palestine and we want it now, and minimalists who were afraid that even this might offend some of the most important powers who they needed. So ultimately this compromise was reached. Then it went on, the Congress contemplates the following means to the attainment of this end. Number one, the promotion by appropriate means of the settlement in Palestine of Jewish farmers, artisans, and tradesmen. You can hear Herzl kind of gnashing his teeth at this. This was Chovevei Tzion. This was an acceptance of the infiltration method of slow settlement. But note, the promotion by appropriate means of the settlement in Palestine. So there was still some wiggle room for how it was going to be done. Maybe it would mostly be supporting the existing settlements, which Herzl was certainly in favor of doing. He didn't want to see them die out and show a failure for the Zionist movement. But it was a compromise with a focus on Palestine. Second, the organization and uniting of the whole of Jewry by means of appropriate local and overall events in accordance with the country's laws. In other words, we're going to organize, we're going to persuade, we realize that there's a challenge on the level of ideas, but we don't want to get those Russian secret police very angry, or the legal authorities in any other country. Number three, the strengthening and fostering of Jewish national sentiment and national consciousness. This was a reaction to those people who said, Zionism of Theodor Herzl is soulless. There's no Judaism here. There's no Bible here. There's no Torah here. There's no peoplehood here. It's all political. No, we're going to foster Jewish national sentiment and national consciousness. Again, a compromise between those who might have wanted something more robust and those who were afraid to touch this. And finally, preparatory steps toward obtaining the consent of the governments where necessary in order to reach the goals of Zionism. Concrete step, we're going to move forward with an agenda of building a Jewish state. Now, last thing I want to touch on is the impact of the Congress. And again, it was Herzl who summed it up better than anyone else, and in fact summed it up twice better than anyone else. And I'll begin with the one that's really iconic. I think we've all heard the words. It's from Herzl's diary just a few days after the Congress ended. Were I to sum up the Basel Congress in a word, which I shall be very careful not to do publicly, it would be this. At Basel, I founded the Jewish state. If I said this out loud today, I would be answered by universal laughter. Perhaps in 5 years and certainly in 50, everyone will admit it. Now, this became iconic after the State of Israel was established. Right? He wrote this September of 1897, roughly 50 years after that, the United Nations voted for partition and for the creation of a Jewish state. And people noted not only that Herzl had had this confidence in Basel that the state would indeed arise, but that his certainly in 50 was exactly right. But as a number of biographers of Herzl, including Shlomo Avineri and Yoram Chazoni, have pointed out, the key is actually in what Herzl writes immediately after, as follows. The foundation of a state lies in the will of the people for a state. Territory is only the material basis. The state, even when it possesses territory, is always something abstract. It was at Basel that I created this abstract entity, which, as such, is invisible to the vast majority of people. And with such infinitesimal means, I gradually worked the people into the mood of a state and made them feel that they were its national assembly. In other words, when he wrote, in Basel I founded the Jewish state, he didn't mean that metaphorically, he didn't mean that rhetorically, he actually believed that the state existed from that moment. Because the state was not about a piece of territory guarded by your own soldiers, in which your own farmers grew your own crops for your own GDP. A state, first and foremost, exists subjectively in the minds of a people, a national grouping, who believe that they're connected to each other, who believe that they have a certain destiny, and believe that they want to be in the same place building and maintaining that state. And Herzl, with all of the choreography, all of the speeches, and all of the symbols, and the flags, and the tuxedos, and the words, and everything else, believed, and I think quite correctly, that in Basel he had formed that national consciousness. Now, there was plenty more work to be done, and I'm not making the case that millions of Jews immediately wanted to be part of it, but it began with that group of people in Basel and with the reports that filtered out from Basel as to what had happened, and the state was founded there. It still had to be grown, still had to be established, still had to be located, but in Basel he founded the Jewish state. This was the private version for his diary, obviously not published until much later. But in the newspaper that he had established, Die Welt, about a week after he had written his diary entry, he wrote the public version, which is the way he wanted people, Jews and others, to understand it then. And listen carefully to his words. Anyone who was in Basel during those 3 days of awakening Jewish history will indignantly reject the carping of malicious men. A number of people did go there to have a good laugh, but they lost their desire to laugh when the Jewish nation, poor, tortured, bleeding from many wounds, presumed and pronounced dead, yet unable and unwilling to die, suddenly arose before them in all the majesty of its suffering and with the gleam of hope in its eye. We are an unfortunate people, but a people, one people. The one point which has been informally recognized as the basis of our movement, the creation of a home for our people, for those Jews unwilling or unable to assimilate elsewhere, has now been given solemn sanction by the Congress. We have submitted this principle to the judgment of the world as the expression of our national will, and now solemnly await its verdict. Here's what Herzl wanted people to take away from this event, from this Zionist Congress, was a sense that something remarkable had happened, that there really was a Jewish people, that they had acted the role, that when he had written about this in the Jewish state, it wasn't just an empty dream. There really were people who felt that way, and a lot of them, and deeply. And they had made a statement. You could now go out and say, this is the Basel platform. This is what the Zionist Congress has declared on behalf of the Jewish people, and I, Theodor Herzl, sit here with you, the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, with you, the Kaiser of the German Empire, and I represent a people who stand behind this. And looking back at these results, I think we can sum up pretty easily what was accomplished in meeting the three challenges of establishing a Jewish state. Intellectually, even though not a lot of new powerful arguments were added to the repertoire of arguments why a Jewish state was desirable and feasible, the very fact that this group had gotten together and made the declaration they made in the Basel program made it just so much more credible that the state could come alive. And if it could come alive, and you could begin to imagine it, made it that much more desirable. So the Congress advanced the intellectual goal of establishing the Jewish state. In terms of institution building, this was de facto the Society of Jews. This was the Jewish people, not all of them, but enough of them coming together and forming an institution that would not only meet once, but that would have a constant presence, yearly, but also daily. So it was crucial for institution building. And finally, in terms of diplomacy, this gave Herzl the card he had been waiting for to really accelerate his diplomacy with the leading powers of the world. So Herzl made a bet the farm kind of a decision. It proved to be strategically the right decision. It was executed on balance with remarkable success and with the results that could be hoped for. And as we will see in the next two lectures, this was the beginning of Herzl's career really as an institution builder and the acceleration of his efforts as a diplomat. And when the intellectual side, the institution building side, and the diplomatic side came together, Herzl really began to come into his own as the founder of the Jewish state. Thank you.
Herzl holds this Congress in Basel, and what happens?
Well, I think the first thing that we have to understand is what Herzl believed had happened. Right? Herzl wrote very famously in his diary, a short time after the Congress ended, "In Basel I founded the Jewish state." He goes on to say, if I were to say it now, people would laugh at it, but in 5 years, certainly in 50, this will be clear to everyone. This is regularly misunderstood to be hyperbole. He didn't really mean he founded the Jewish state. What he meant is that he laid the very beginning, and from now on, it was clear what the path was going to be. But I think, and in this I'm basing myself very much on the interpretation of Yoram Chazoni, Herzl actually believed he had founded the Jewish state, because to him, the essential part of the state was its subjective element, the sense that the people have that we are a people and we want a state and we can build that state and we will build that state. And in Basel, what Herzl thought he had created, and I think with good reason, is that sense of we are a people, we are going to build a state, it's always been in our hearts and now it's going to be out there on the map. And that he really had, at least among the people who were present and among many, many thousands of people who weren't there but read about it or heard about it. He really led them to believe that this was a state in the making and they were its sovereign parliamentary body, its constituent assembly, if you will. So I think the most important thing to understand is what Herzl believed had happened there. What happened beyond that, I think, were two things, one in the realm of institution building and one in the realm of diplomacy. In the realm of institution building, the Congress was not a one-off, what Israelis would call zbang v'gamarnu, something you just do it once and you don't have to worry about it again. It created a mechanism in which there would be conferences held annually. That was the Jewish people reasserting itself. That was the Jewish people as the sovereign through these representatives. And so the Congress, this one-time Congress, created the Congress as a permanent fixture. It created a series of bodies that were meant to take action, right? The Greater Actions Committee, the Smaller Actions Committee, and they were meant to pursue the various goals, whether diplomatic or economic or practical or in the realm of communication. And it paved the way for a series of actions that led to the creation of a Jewish National Fund, that led to the creation of a bank. In fact, if you'll fast forward, a huge amount of what became the state in the making between 1897 and 1948, when that state arose, these were institutions that grew out of the Congress. That's one part. The second part is diplomatically. It pretty clearly had an impact on Herzl's ability, together with his allies, to conduct diplomacy, because he really was able to say at this point, this is the Basel program. I represent the Basel program. It was voted on by a assembly, which he could plausibly enough claim, especially to those who didn't know the details, was an assembly representative of the Jewish people. So it really strengthened the institutions and it strengthened the diplomacy, and it also put Herzl himself in a different position. If before he was a leader around whom people were starting to form, he was now the acknowledged leader. He was voted on as the person to head the Zionist movement. So it was a transformative event.